Great. So
we're going to talk about the RFP again today?
We are. And
going to have anything left to talk about next week?
Well, yeah, we're going to do, I thought this would be a good approach. We each session from now on, we're going to take one or two of the criteria. Today we're going to talk about ranking criteria, which are going to be community need, and the other one, which is this program description.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to go in detail on them. And if we do that, we could continue through that so that we'll have hit basically all of the processes you need to complete the grant successfully, and also all of the things that would make a program work well. So today, for example, we'll do community need and program description, and that's 47 points out of the 100. And then next time we'll talk about program capability and institutional capacity, and then the next time community and employment partnerships, and then budget resources. And then that'll bring us, you know, through the whole grant, and we can try to.
So then, what are we going to do on the 28th?
Well, then
we're just
going to
do the same thing, only just the whole thing at one time.
Yeah, then we could do so on the.
And then on the 11th for questions.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, two each time. So, the 19th. So on the 2nd, we're going to do the. We'll do program capability and institutional policy, and then on the 16th, we'll do. The community employment and budget resources, and then on the next one we can do a kind of a summation. We're going to be coming down to the wire about that time.
No, I was talking about the extra ones that we were going to do.
Oh, I'm wondering if we would need an extra one if we do that. We could do an extra one if you think that there is going to be that demand. I'm thinking that everyone that joins these will be are the ones who are concerned about it.
The thing is that the people that are invited to these PLC sessions are just the PLC members, and what we were going to do for those additional conference calls were
everybody
out on the two listservs,
mm-hmm.
which is a different group,
yeah.
two different groups of people.
They are a little bit different groups. We can do that. When do you think that would be a good time to do it?
Well, I thought we had kind of tentatively scheduled them for the 28th and the 11th.
Okay. We could try that.
On a Friday. Remember we talked about that?
Yes, I see it. I see it. January 28th. We could do that. And then we could announce that right away and see how the 28th goes. And then.
We can just see if there's a need for the one on the 11th.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That would be fine.
Well,
you're right
I'm,
about that.
Huh?
There are two different groups. Hello?
Hi, who just joined us?
This is Kevin Kilo with the City of Gallup.
Hi, Kevin, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing good, thanks.
Good.
How are things in Gallup?
Oh, they're good. You know, they're moving along. Looks like we're partnering with ASU on our program.
Excellent.
And, they seem to have a lot of capacity to help us out.
Excellent. It's amazing. There are schools out there that have really developed nice programs, and they're looking for partners. And it sounds like it'll be a perfect relationship.
Yep.
Between the two of you. You all surviving the strange winter weather there?
Oh, it got so cold here. It was like negative 20 one morning.
Oh my goodness.
Walked to work. Yeah. Yeah, we're usually more around negative 10 or 0, so it was quite
cool.
Wow.
Now, do you have gas or do you have heat pumps out there?
Mostly we have, I have radiated heat, and that's what we have a lot through City Hall. So,
wow.
Yeah, we're kind of ancient around here.
Wow. So
it's one of the things with the brownfields, the environmental workforce training, is that, of course, you know, these old buildings have a lot of asbestos and lead. So.
Right.
So good
right.
demand.
That's right. There's lots of demand. You don't think of New Mexico as having a lot of environmental, but they do. They do.
Mm-hmm.
The Northeast tends to be blessed with all kinds of environmental issues. But
hi, who just joined us?
Rebecca Rose, Cochise College.
Hey, Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
We were just talking about New Mexico and the strange weather they've been getting. I think everybody's been getting strange weather in the last week or so. We've had in North Carolina abnormally cold, and then we had ice and just nasty things. Not the snow, though. So
we've had a lot of here in Iowa. We've had lots of snow, lots of ice. Had a little bit more snow this morning. Having a little bit more tonight, tomorrow.
Oh,
72 degrees and beautiful here.
Oh,
really?
That's disgusting.
Rebecca, you got to be kidding. Really?
It's wonderful. It's an absolutely beautiful day.
Wow.
Kids are wandering around campus in shorts.
Isn't
that? Oh, I can't imagine.
This is Forrest.
Who is that?
My name is Forrest Aldering. I'm with Youth Build Louisville.
Oh, great. Great.
Yeah.
Do we have your, yes, Forrest.
Yeah, it's in there, Mike.
Great. Yeah, good.
Yep. I was on the last conference call, too, but I was a quiet spectator.
Youth
well, that's okay,
great,
too.
It's a great
yeah.
organization. Now, Forrest, do you have a grant currently?
We are, yes, we from the DOL.
Yes, oh, great, okay. Someone just joined?
Yeah, Daniel from North Star.
Okay, Daniel.
And someone else?
Yes, this is Marie Walker and Caitlin Williams from the Citizens Conservation Corps in West Virginia.
Okay. Caitlin, good. We've got a good geographical mix of everyone coming in. We've got New Mexico, Iowa, North Carolina, West Virginia. We'll get started today, and there might be some more joining in. One of the things that I always want to do as a disclaimer, because we're getting into the grant season for the re-up on this grant, we're going to be talking about for the next couple sessions not only what they're looking for in the EPA grant, but also what you need to do to improve your program and make it more efficient and make it better. So we're kind of doing two things at once. We're working on what's a good program, job training program, but then also what is EPA going to be looking for in the grant review process for the upcoming grants. Now, we have to add the disclaimer. We are a grantee of, HMTRI is a grantee of EPA, but we don't speak for them, and everything we say is just our opinion. So we're a little bit on the outside like everyone else, but we've been working at this since the beginning of the program. Someone just joined us?
Yes, this is Adrian Wells from the Green Team in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Hey Adrian.
Hi.
So we just wanted to disclaim the fact that whatever we say or whatever Adrian says or Rebecca are just our opinions and may or may not be accurate or truthful. But most of us, we've got enough people online that have been around since the beginning of this program. We know I'm a former EPA person. We've worked with the program since it was first started, and have been doing this since 1987. So we're kind of old hands at it. But, again, we kind of know the way EPA thinks, but you never can tell when they go off in a different direction. One thing about the grant that they're going to be reviewing is, and we've talked about this in previous calls, they use contractors to cover the threshold criteria, and these are just the things that you qualify for writing the grant. Can you receive federal money, and are your page limits 18 pages for the narrative and 20 for the attachments? The contractors are very strict. They're given orders. This is what you do. This is how you prepare for the reviewers. You just do this. Don't ask questions. If they run 19 pages, just tear the page off and just give us 18. If they go to 25 pages on the attachment, tear off the last five and give us the 20, the first 20. So you've got to keep that in mind in the writing process. Then we get down to the nitty-gritty, the real evaluation of the grant. And one thing about grants, in the old days, they used fewer people submitting grant proposals. So they were able to be a little more subjective, and they could do site visits and they could talk to the principal investigators. And now there's, when you start talking about 100 or so grants that'll be coming in, they have to try to be more objective, and all of the agencies are doing this. They're basically turning the grant process into a test, an essay test, so to speak. And in this case, we've got 6 essay questions, and they assign weights to each of those questions. And then they try to, again, make it as objective as possible so that the readers, one person can't read all of these grants. So what they do is they're going to take the 6, they're going to cut them up, and they'll give them to teams. And each team will evaluate a different question, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So you have 6 teams. For example, a team is going to work on community need, which is the first one. And the perfect score is 20 and, of course, 0. And then the next team will do training and program description, and they'll be worth 27 points. Again, the best score being 27 and 0. You can't assume, and I don't believe what will happen, is everyone won't get the full grant. Assume that they're going to get your question. So when you're writing to community need, you can't assume that you said it somewhere else in the grant, that they're going to understand it and that they've read, that one person has read your whole grant. And, oh, we know that they said this in this other part, so we know they're going to do that. Assume they're not going to. So when you address community need, it's got to be a standalone, almost like you're submitting a grant just for community need or just for the program description, and write as if they know nothing about your program except that very specific issue. The other thing that's important to note as an overview is they're trying to be subjective, so they're going to look at everything. The RFP guidelines are official documents. So they're going to take these sentence by sentence and say, okay, it says provide a description of your community. You need to respond, provide a description of your community. If you don't, you can get points off. Every sentence in there needs to be addressed very specifically. So, as I said, each section stands alone. And every sentence has to be answered. So what we're going to do is look today at the first 2 ranking criteria, and this will decide who gets grants and who doesn't. And one is 20 points, and the program description is 27, so that's a total of 47 points. So that's almost half the program right there.
Hi, this is Marie.
Hey, Marie. How are you? We're going through ranking criteria in evaluating who's going to get these grants. But if you're not submitting a grant, it's still useful because one thing about EPA is they've written the grants exactly to the way we found a successful program to operate. So if you write this grant well, you've really done everything that they've found over the last 10 years, everything you need to know to run a successful program. So I would say if you write this grant well and participate in it, when you get the money, you're going to have an easy time if you follow your grant proposal, because you're going to have done pretty much everything the way they found that seems to be pretty successful. So those of you who have gotten grants before, well, let's first start talking about community need. We want to talk about community need and the first 2, and training program description. And this community need is extremely important. It's a value of 20 points. And it's basically your needs assessment. I think Rebecca and those have been around for a while. They probably have heard us talk about needs assessment for the last year and how important it is to do your needs assessment and how important needs assessments are. And the question is, well, what is a needs assessment? And they take several forms. It's a way of characterizing your community. What is the need for people in your community? And we call it a labor market assessment. You would also describe your community in great detail. You have to assume you're going to recruit from the neighborhood, of course. And what is that neighborhood? You know, if you're living, if your program is located in a suburb and you're not embedded in the community, you're going to really have to describe the community. The ideal community is one where there is a real issue in the community which you could describe. You've got demographics, high unemployment in terms of people having a difficult time getting jobs. You've got special situations where you have industries that have either moved out and left abandoned properties, or there are industries that are causing contamination. So you, in this very first part, you're describing the fishbowl that you live in, and also the fishbowl that you're going to be working in. If your program isn't located in that neighborhood, you're going to have to describe how you're going to interact there. Where are you going to be doing the training, for example? Are you going to be doing the training in that community, or are people going to be taking the bus to a suburb somewhere and going to a different facility? So these are important keys to note there. As I said, you want to answer these questions almost line by line. When you talk about needs assessment, you don't want to just take published figures. Published figures are nice, but that's not really a needs assessment when it gets down to environmental technology and jobs. We find that our program is very specialized, and if you do a general needs assessment, you're not going to get really good numbers. And the numbers you're going to get are not going to help you. What you're looking for is who are going to hire your trainees after they graduate, and what companies are going to hire them, and how specific are they going to do that. And we found the best needs assessments seem to be two types. One is a general survey where you identify specific industries that would hire people that you're going to be training, and then also personal interviews. And actually the absolute best needs assessments are having people on board who are saying and willing to say, I'll hire everyone you graduate, or I'll hire people from your program who have this and this training. And that's a really powerful needs assessment. If you could come up with numbers and industries, and even the more specific you get, the better your needs assessment is going to be. I think that, Rebecca, you have and you've told the story, I think, last week, but do you want to repeat you've got a very special, let's use that as an example, the characterization of the employer in your community.
Well, our largest employer for our graduates from the Pathways Out of Poverty grant, which is kind of the foundation for what we're going to do with the Brownfields grant, is Freeport-McMoRan, the mining company, who bought out Phelps Dodge, who had mined here in Cochise County, you know, for half a century, and left behind a really big mess. And so they are now remediating that and have contracted with Shaw Environmental, who are willing to pretty much take just about anybody we get through the program.
Excellent. Now, let's take this as an example. If, Rebecca, you were going to describe your community, how would you describe it then?
Mine scarred. We're right on the Mexican border, so we have high unemployment and a number of labor issues. After the mines closed, there was a lot of we're also Arizona, where we have all of these people who were in construction industry and have been jobless for a long time. So we have high unemployment, and we have an employer who's looking for people with this kind of training. So we have a really good mix.
Excellent. Now, here's the basis for a really good narrative in the community needs section. You're describing your community. Now, if you can get some numbers that you could, and those can be generic numbers in terms of what you may want to contact your local economic development agency to get. He can give you specific numbers on people who are unemployed, maybe the demographic mix. You describe your community very well. You're embedded in your community, it sounds like, so that you're there. And then you go on to your needs assessment. You've got your prime candidate for hiring your students is going to be this one particular company, and you and it would be great to even name it and to and further on, later on when you get in the grant, you might want to see if you can get them as a reference and have them call them. And even extending further to the extent that you could get them to be on your board, you really see how these things are all locking together. You've got you've demonstrated your community need, your needs assessment, and you can go into additional detail beyond just the one company. But then naming names and providing some numbers, the numbers you can get from your local economic development commission, but not being afraid to put all these very specific numbers into the grant proposal, because that's exactly what they're looking for. When they look at generalities, they say, yeah, sure, everyone can write, any grant writer off the street can write a great grant, but it doesn't mean that the grant is going to be great. It's going to mean that they know how to talk in generalities. What they're going to be looking for is very specific numbers to the extent you can get them. Now, everyone's not going to be able to do this to the extent Rebecca's got a very special situation, but you might have in your town, maybe not a Freeport-McMoRan, but you may have some other major employers. And what you may have to do is start looking now to try to find some employers that might hire your people. You may want to talk to the local brownfields, if there is the local DNR, certainly. Try to find out who the prime remediation companies are. See if they will work with you and work with your students in terms of hiring your students. This is really key in this whole community need characterization. They're going to be looking to see, most important, can you place your students? And they're basing that whether you can place your students on your needs assessment. And if you can't demonstrate in your needs assessment, the next question is how are you going to place 70% of your students? So does that give everyone an idea of what you need to be doing in your needs assessment? To the extent that you could get very specific interviews with people, name names, name companies, and you can combine it with some general data, but make sure you get the very specific data in there. You also, where are you going to be recruiting from? You've got to demonstrate, and Rebecca, again, has a very specific target group. She's recruiting from a very specific group that she's going to identify. Who are you going to recruit from your neighborhood? And how are you going to get to those people? How are you going to, are you going to work through churches? Are you going to work with community organizations? And clearly, if you're going to work with community organizations, you're going to want to name them, and you're going to want to get names. And this is a good time because you still have time. When we get towards the end of this, as we get closer to March 18th, it's going to be harder to do these things quickly. But right now, you really need to be gathering names and phone numbers of people you can use as references, and particularly getting your needs assessment together.
One of the things, this is Rebecca, one of the things I'd recommend after, as part of our success with the Pathways Grant and part of what I'm writing in as I work on the Brownfields Grant, is that what's made the Pathways Grant so successful is the case manager, the person who actually goes out, finds the people, works with them to get them through the process. And having that role, and it hasn't worked, our local Cochise County Workforce Development Office helps, but and they've been involved, but they haven't been able, we haven't had the success on grants with them that we've had by using a case manager. And that's made all the difference in finding these people and getting them successfully through the process.
So that you're actually suggesting that a grantee identify a particular person whose job it is going to be to get in the community, and you're calling them a case manager, and someone else might be working with community groups, but they have to be very familiar with what you do and how you work, don't they?
Yes.
this is really keys into this second evaluation point, which is this training program description. And we may have to go into this in more detail at a later time, but they're asking for this 70% placement rate. And they're going to ask, how are you going to reach 70% of placement? And Rebecca just hit a good answer again. You've got someone that's going to be solely responsible for bringing them in, taking care of them, making sure they stay in the program, and getting them out and tracking them. And this is key in your writing of your training program description. How are you going to place them and how are you going to track them? And it sounds like you've got someone that's specifically assigned to that, and it sounds like that's worked really well for you.
Yeah, it has. And we've been involved in three of these stimulus fund or related grants, the WIRED grant, a CBJT grant, and then the Pathways grant. WIRED and CBJT were not nearly as successful. And part of it, I think, was having the case manager out there in the community working directly with our population of students.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. A great idea. When we get into this second point of the training program description, this tends to be a little more objective, and it's going to be things like charts, how many cycles, what courses are you going to put on, what's going to be your core training, your required training, your supplemental training, what kind of awareness training you're going to do, how many hours per cycle are you going to be training, what certifications will people earn, and there's a sleeper in there that they address is, what are you doing regarding health and safety in the training process? And you want to make sure that you include health and safety training for your students and for your students as they participate in the program to make sure that they're safe. These are going to be in this section. It's a very important section. It's 27 points. You're going to very specifically have to address everything that they're required by law to address. And when you go into the grant, there is a section. And I'll put this in the post-session notes on page 9, things that you're going to have to make sure you include. And when you get to a section like this, training program description, they're going to be looking for these very specific points. Are you going to be at least placing, if you're going to place 50% of the people, you're out because they're requiring you to place at least 70%. If you're going to place 100%, you need to explain how you're going to get to 100% or 80%. And again, I think Rebecca's issue of justification, if she says 80%, Rebecca, did you put a number on your last grant in terms of your placement?
We had to agree, the target was 125 people in the job for 6 months. Okay. So it wasn't a percentage, it was a number placed.
Oh, okay. And so you had to train 125 people. Did you start with 125 people or did you start with a whole lot more?
500.
100, wow.
100.
100 people. Mm-hmm. So you were going for 100% placement.
No, 500.
Oh, 500. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Wow. So out of training 500, you had to place 125.
Well, and, you know, we have a lot of attrition, a lot of people who haven't had a job in a long time coming into this program have work ethic issues.
Right.
And so a lot of them go in. We have a two-day soft skills program that they go through that they have to successfully complete before they can be placed in the HAZWOP and the backhoe and those classes. And so we had kind of a screening mechanism.
Right.
And then but most of the people who made it to the HAZWOP class, we've had almost 100% completion of HAZWOP, and those are the people that we're placing as soon as they finish the program.
See, now that's very interesting because this whole issue of 70% is, we hear grantees saying, there is no way in this job market we're going to place 70%. And
hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
Al Dyson, I'm sorry, I just got on a few minutes ago. What are some of the places that you target for placement, you know, in your community?
Well,
typical places. I know people like Clean Harbors,
Right.
It does a lot of cleanup, but that's
well,
one of the
Rebecca's got a perfect example, and now hers is a special situation. She's got Freeport Mac Moran, who's got all kinds of mines. It's a huge company, and they're doing a lot of mine operations, and she can track right down to the company. You want to go into companies that are using people, cleanup companies. If you don't have cleanup companies in your neighborhood or area, it becomes a little more difficult. The best thing to do is to go to the DNR and find out who is doing the contracting in your area. What contractors do you have? Who's getting the jobs? Now, hopefully there's someone local, and they're the ones you want to go to. There's another part of this grant that's going to ask you, do you have any first choice agreements? Are there any first choice hiring programs? And this is a good time to kind of hit two birds with one stone. Find out from your economic development people, one, who's doing the work, and two, are there any incentive programs for your graduates, for people hiring people in brownfields? North Carolina, for example, for a while had a program that provided employers incentives to hire people that would work on brownfields. You may or may not have a program, and it may be a temporary program, but you want to find out, one, are there any tax incentive programs that you can use or point to? Second, you want to find out if there are any employers in your area, and are there any first hiring agreements? In California, St. Louis, different communities have first hire agreements where they have to look to see if there's someone local that could fill the job first. Sometimes these first hiring agreements are kind of a sham. They just post something on a bulletin board and on the eighth floor of some building, and if nobody shows up, well, then it opens the spigot to hire whoever they want. But some people are much more fair about that, and I think most of them are. If the biggest problem is they don't know about your program, and if they don't know about it, they can't help you. So you want to get around and let people know that you're going to have graduates, and can you use either first hiring or can you use incentive programs? But Al, to address your specific question, and I was saying you got to, in your needs assessment, you're going to have to, you really want to name names and get people
right,
references.
Right. So, just from you talking, I think probably my best approach is to probably contact my local EPA rep that does hazardous materials. I tend to know that guy. He may know the main companies that do the cleanup. And then
yeah,
I should target those companies.
That's a good start. That's a really good start. Target those companies. Now, keep in mind, you're not asking these companies to hire 100 people or 1,000 people. You're asking them to hire one or two. Your classes, if your classes are 10 or 15, the nice thing about these programs, we're not talking, this is not a massive jobs program. We're talking about tens, not hundreds. It adds up to hundreds. If you got 10 grants or 12 grants each doing 100 or 10 or 20 people a cycle, you've got 100 to 200. They're looking for a national goal of 400 people. So under 10 grants, that's only 40 per grantee. So if you can get a couple of employers that say, I'll try you. I'll hire two of your people, or I'll hire one or two of your people. We've been talking about this. We're looking for to diversify our program. We'd like to help the community. We'd like to demonstrate that we're part of the community. We'll bring your people, and particularly if they've got certifications, we'll use them and try them out. And once, I guarantee you, once you get your people in a company, you're going to get more business from them, because what's going to happen, they're going to get in there and they're going to find out they're well-trained, they're certified, they've been through your screening process, so they're there. I mean, and what it costs a company to bring someone up to one of these cert levels is several thousand dollars. A HAZWOPER alone costs $600, confined space, $300. General construction is about $100. So these things really add up fast. So I would contact, you know, any remediation company you have, Of course, the bigger the company, the more likely they have room for one or two more people. If you're talking about a small firm, it gets a little trickier. But hit those companies first. Then, after you hit the remediation companies and the environmental companies, go to the second tier, which are the UPSs of the world, the large manufacturing companies. You'd be amazed. One of the weaknesses with labor market assessment is you send out a assessment form, and people say, well, we have no environmentalists in our company. Well, yeah, they have lots of them. They just don't know. They don't call them environmentalists, but they're doing environmental jobs. They're tracking the hazardous materials. They're in charge of spill response. They may be in charge of labeling. They're making sure they meet the OSHA and the EPA requirements. In fact, they're great jobs. They're very secure, and they're there forever because the companies need to have them. But they're not going to. They don't call them environmental. You look in the paper. In fact, Department of Labor, you can't even find a job description for environmentalists. And I went to work with EPA as I was hired in the public health service as a sanitarian of all things, whatever that was, because there's no job description for an environmental position. So you're either often you're a you might be a welder, you might be a backhoe operator, you might be a pipe fitter or a carpenter or a painter, but you're doing basically environmental jobs. You may be a painter, but you're doing asbestos removal. You know, you might be. They did open an interesting category. It was freon removal, freon mitigation from white goods. There was an interesting. We talked about this earlier in the year, and they put in the RFP. Waste dumps receive white goods, and white goods have freon potential to have them. Now, many localities require you have to, if you have a white good, a refrigerator that has freon, the freon has to be removed. Someone has to certify that freon has been removed. And if it's going to be removed, it has to be removed properly by a certified freon remover. So we're talking about an environmental job. Who would ever thought that your local waste site may have specific jobs for people that are trained in freon? But that's somewhere you need to go. Another thing is that they're very much interested in hazardous materials and solid waste removal. So you need to check with all of your landfills and your waste operations to see if there may be positions there that your students can fill. And when you ask people if they may have some jobs that can be filled, always tell them that your students are going to be certified and what certifications they're going to have, because their ears will perk up. If you have someone going to work at a landfill and, oh, by the way, he's HAZWOPR trained, he's asbestos trained, he's freon trained, he's got all these certifications and training, their ears will perk up very quickly because it's hard to find people with those certs. And now, remember, when you're doing this, it's going to all tie into your needs assessment. It's going to tie into your references. If you get along well with the person you're talking to, ask them if you could use their name, and tell them to remember what your discussion's about, because you'd like to use them in your grant proposal, and get your collection of names to when you start writing this grant. So, well, our 30 minutes, we try to keep these down to 30-minute calls. So, anyone have any questions about these first two sections in writing this grant, or questions about what they've done that they feel has really been helpful in terms of their addressing these two issues?
Okay. I just think the 70% placement may be a challenge in today's market. That's the only thing I'm concerned about right now.
Al, it's going to be a tremendous challenge. Now, let me add this. The question has been asked, are they going to claw back your money if you don't do 70%? And the answer is no. Are they going to come?
Oh, okay. So you just got to target 70% and write up what your strategy is for doing it, you know.
Yeah, you need to do that, and they need to evaluate to make sure that you've got a good strategy. Now,
okay.
you don't have to sign a personal. They're not going to put you in jail if you don't do it. You may. The question is, if you go for a re-up and you place 20% or 40%, your strategy obviously didn't work, and you may not get a re-up on it.
Okay.
But you can, you know, I think what you need to do is you need to provide a realistic number, and then you need to tell them how you're going to do it. And I think Rebecca has a good strategy. She's got someone that's solely responsible. After graduation, she's just not letting these people go off on their own and say, go get a job. She's got a very proactive program with caseworkers who are going to be getting them the jobs. And you're going to have to not only get them the job, but, you know, call them up every 6 months. We're not talking about 100 people. We're talking about, you know, 10 or 15 people. Call them up and how's the job going? And they say, well, I got laid off. Well, come on back. We're going to help you get another one, you know.
Yeah.
So you got to be real proactive. There are grantees who are shooting. They're shooting for 100%. And I think we may have some that are just 100%. They say, well, we're playing small. Now,
well, you know, I don't want to drag it out, but I think the jobs are out there, because when you just mentioned that a lot of them are not labeled jobs, but I know a lot of guys that are general contractors, for instance, that, you know, do construction like building schools and hospitals, et cetera. Well, a lot of the labor work for us controlling all the demolition materials and things like that, they call them laborers, but a lot of times they're dealing with hazardous materials and doing different things. And personally, I don't think a lot of them, in some cases, may even be properly trained. And
well, you're right.
They don't know that they're supposed to have this training.
You're right, Al. And not only that, like I say, you're placing 10, 15 people, and these are people that have certifications. So you're right. If you've got a construction worker, someone working in demolition, and your guy's got these certifications, he may not be doing environmental 100% of the time, but for example, they're working at, say he's a welder, and all of a sudden they get called into a refinery, there's asbestos. Well, who's got asbestos certs here? And maybe nobody. You're exactly right. Or you're doing painting, and all of a sudden we've got a pre-1978 building, and we've got a problem with lead. Who's got this? Who's got the RRMP certification? Who out there does? Well, you could provide a painter. In fact, if you've got guys that are trained in RRMP, and you go to your major painting contractors and you just say, oh, by the way, you know, if you're looking for someone, I've got guys with lead training certifications. And I think that if he's doing old buildings, he'd be crazy not to have your guy on board. Just in case, because he's going to have that certification, you know.
Yeah.
That's exactly
and
right.
One, this is Rebecca again. One way I think that we have a partner with our workforce development, and they will do the soft skills training class so that before we even put them on the list as being into our program, we've gotten them through the screening process so that we know that the people who are going into our program, we have a much better chance of placing 70% than we would if we just counted that 500 we're starting with the Pathways grant.
There you go. There you go. You've really screened. You've done a pre-screen. Mm-hmm. It's a great idea. Great idea. So you know that these fellas are really serious about this. Excellent. Excellent idea. Well, listen, we'll put some things in post-session notes, and any of you, if you've got some questions, or if you want to ask some questions of EPA, if you just respond to me an email, we'll send them to Joe in EPA so he could respond to everyone. And so if you do have any questions or something you didn't have a chance to ask today, just email me. I'll be sending you post-session notes, and anyone who missed the call can get a recording of this call. And there'll be instructions on how to do that, or they could visit our toolbox, brownfieldstoolbox.org. Glo, do you want to repeat that so that they have that?
It's brownfields-toolbox, just the way it's spelled, B-R-O-W-N FIELDS-toolbox, T-O-O-L-B-O-X, .org.
Good. And I'll send post-session notes. If for some reason I'm getting blocked, I think most of the emails are going through. If you're not getting them, just send me an email that you didn't get the notes. They usually go out in the next 2 to 3 days. So, and we'll meet again in 2 weeks, which will be February 2nd, same time, same place. And we can pick up some of these topics and things we missed here, and then we're going to talk about this program capability and instructional capacity on that next call and go from there. So we won't see you next week, but we'll see you on February 2nd. So we'll talk to you all later then. Have a good day.